Our final presenter today is Mr. Nolan Klein. Oh, got it right. Okay. Nolan Klein is a PhD candidate in the Department of Anthropology and an MPH student in the Department of Community and Family Health at the University of South Florida. His dissertation research examines how immigration policies and police practices impact undocumented immigrants' health in Atlanta, Georgia, and shape health providers' professional practices. So today is going to be presenting on efforts to address family violence, how localized immigration enforcement impacts undocumented Latino immigrants.
So much, and I have no relationships to disclose, so I apologize in advance if I go through this rather hastily. I do want to save some time for questions. So I just want to briefly discuss that this is actually research that is for my dissertation that looks at a broader theme and health-related consequences of immigrant policing in Atlanta, Georgia. By immigrant policing, I'm referring specifically to immigration policies and police practices that render undocumented immigrants more visible to police and increase the risk for deportation. So I'm looking in particular at what I'm calling multi-layered immigration enforcement. And this comprises state laws such as HB 87 in Georgia. This is the most notorious state law that is a copycat of Arizona's SB 1070. HB 87 allows for police to stop, arrest, and detain anyone suspected of being an undocumented immigrant, and essentially has opened the doors for racial profiling. The response to this has been a large number of activist groups charging for a call to change this law. Federal statutes also operate at local levels that complement laws like HB 87, one of them being 287G. 287G is a federal effort that deputizes local police and allows them to enforce federal immigration law, and another program called Secure Communities, which is a fingerprint sharing program. So the way that these laws work, police are allowed to stop and arrest anyone suspected of being an undocumented immigrant through HB 87. All these things work together through routine traffic enforcement. So Georgia does not allow for undocumented immigrants to obtain a driver's license. So when police stop you and arrest you because you were driving without a license, you are taken to jail, your fingerprints are checked through Secure Communities, and they're assessed against a national database to determine whether or not you're a citizen or a legal permanent resident. And at that point, the jailhouse 287G officer issues your deportation order, and you are sent to a detention center, often to wait for years, until you are finally deported. So Atlanta proved to be a perfect site to do this kind of research because Atlanta is home to a growing Latino immigrant population that historically has come to the area for work in the agricultural and poultry processing industries. Around 1995, however, as Georgia was preparing for the Atlanta Olympic Games, there was a concern that construction projects were not going to be done on time. So state and city officials met with the Mexican consulate and begged for the Mexican consulate to bring over labor to Atlanta, and then they would sort out the immigration concerns later. You're probably expecting that those immigration concerns did not get sorted out, and no, they did not. So, of course, around 2008, when the economic crisis hit, a swath of immigration laws started passing in the Georgia legislature, and of course that's when HB 87 was proposed. So you see, again, that Atlanta is the site of this multi-layered immigration enforcement regime because every jurisdiction in Atlanta, every county participates in Secure Communities and 287G. So overall, the goals of my dissertation research, which was largely qualitative study, were to examine these multi-level impacts of layered immigration laws, these layers of state and federal policies that combine and synergistically impact immigrants' abilities to seek health services. And I also wanted to look at how health providers in particular and organizations, immigrant rights groups, are actually implicated in governing immigrant populations, particularly because HB 87 actually made it a crime for health providers to provide any kind of non-emergent health service. So this means that if you are a health provider and an undocumented immigrant sought preventive health services from you, you could be arrested for committing a crime. And of course, I wanted to look at these health-related impacts of immigrant policing, which manifested in undocumented immigrants avoiding certain types of health services, increased fear in utilizing specific health services, and as I'll discuss today, these family-related impacts, which emerged as a theme during data collection, and relate to intimate partner violence and challenges for organizations attempting to address intimate partner violence. So as a trained anthropologist, I was very much attracted to the social-ecological model for exploring this particular topic. So the goal was to understand how immigrant policing pervades every level of the social-ecological model, and the social-ecological model fits well with broader social science theories looking at health-related vulnerabilities, and also allows for examining broad impacts and specific individual-level impacts. So my data collection was guided by participant observation with immigrant rights groups such as GLAR, the Georgia Latino Alliance for Human Rights, and participant observation experiences in the Georgia Capitol, pictured at the top. You'd be, if you're curious to know, it's probably not surprising that the legislators who passed HB 87 were not as willing to speak to me as you might think. This gives you an overview of the 51 semi-structured interviews I conducted for the research, based on each level of the social-ecological model. So as many of you in this room know, intimate partner violence, or IPV, is any kind of physical, sexual, psychological harm against current or previous spouse, boyfriend, or girlfriend, and it's associated with substantial economic and health-related burdens. For the immigrants who came to Atlanta as part of this construction boom in 1996, intimate partner violence is actually a little bit more complicated. Violence may increase after immigrating to the U.S. Existing violence may be exacerbated by conditions related to immigrating. And immigrants might not actually report their violent situations to authorities because they fear having their immigration status discovered. And this is echoing several of the themes of the earlier presentations about fear of discovery. Language, economic, and social barriers may increase feelings of isolation in addition to serving as barriers to seeking services. And many immigrants may not be aware of services available for violence. For undocumented immigrants, this situation is increasingly complicated by legal status, particularly in mixed status relationships where one partner is undocumented and one partner is not. And fear plays a prominent role in the IPV context in mixed status relationships. So fears of deportation may be, again, a barrier to seeking services, but abusers may use immigration status fears as a method of control and violence. So there are federal protections for those who are experiencing IPV, but federal legislation actually inadequately addresses the needs for immigrants who are at risk or already experiencing IPV. So this, the findings I present here draw largely from interviews with intimate partner violence organizations in Atlanta, one of them being a family-based organization that provides services for men, women, and children, and another being an organization for women only that offers safety planning and a shelter. And as I'll talk about with some key quotations, policing plays a role not only in shaping those who experience IPV and their experiences, but also plays a role in how organizations can provide services to immigrants that seek services. So, from interviews with intimate partner violence service organizations, I found that fear of calling police because immigration status may be discovered was a major reason why people would not reach out to intimate partner violence organizations. And so as one IPV organization leader said, one of the things that we found out was that the kids were actually afraid to call the police because of the fact they thought they could get their mom or dad to be deported. So the kids were put between a rock and a hard place because they were afraid their mom was either going to get killed or that their mom or dad might get deported, and they didn't know what the right thing to do was. So there was this fear in the home of parents potentially being, at worst, murdered, and fear of calling police and not sure which one was worse. Over time, this, of course, leads people to become distrustful of police, even if they reach out to police in violent circumstances. So, again, from another intimate partner violence organization leader, she said, one of my clients, she called the police because her partner was beating her really badly on Christmas, and when the police got there, they just drove him around the block a few times and said, oh, come on, it's Christmas. And then he was even angrier after they left. She won't call the police anymore, so we've had to make new safety plans that include places for her to go, and we've had to tell her she can't call the police. So, as this particular interviewee suggested, revised safety plans have become workarounds in this climate of fearing police intervention. So these safety plans tend to include new ways for children to become independent and leave the home in case there's violence that breaks out, and go somewhere where they can feel safe and not feel as if they are putting themselves or their parents at risk for deportation. So in commenting on this, one organization leader said, "We ended up having to create a new kind of safety plan with the parents. With mom, we work on what kind of documents they need and all that kind of stuff, where the kids should be, who they can feel safe with. And the other thing is that we basically meet with the moms beforehand and tell them one of the things that the kids have to hear from them is that it's okay if they have to call the police if they thought their mom was getting hurt or killed, because they need to hear it from the parents themselves that it was not okay, and that they wouldn't get blamed and that they wouldn't get in trouble." So children were afraid to call police and needed to hear from parents that they wouldn't get in trouble if it happened. So in explaining this connection between immigrant policing and intimate partner violence, numerous organization leaders actually talked about the relationship between immigrant policing and how it exacerbated IPV. And this one quotation from a undocumented youth kind of sums up how parents are stressed and taking it out on each other. Talking about this a bit more, people linked the connection between IPV violence and mobility and lack of work. One person saying in particular, "So now there are a lot more police, so the guy can't get a job because he can't drive and he's frustrated, so he takes it out on his partner. And it's no excuse, but it's just one of those things that makes a bad situation worse." So immigrant policing not only affected undocumented immigrants and their experiences related to IPV, but also affected how organizations could respond to IPV. So some immigrants started avoiding coming to some of the IPV organizations, and one leader reflected on this by saying, "People don't come in for services anymore because they're afraid they're going to get stopped by police, so we've had to make sure we hold our groups somewhere where people feel safe to walk to, because you can actually get stopped in. Arrested for walking if you're undocumented." So I just want to briefly point out that this research points to health-related consequences of immigration laws, and this specifically raises the fact that policy is a key factor in systems-related research in immigrant health, and that immigration laws may impede public health efforts to address family violence and particularly intimate partner violence. And the challenges created for IPV organizations actually then require new strategies and prevention that respond to the role of immigration laws and police practices and family violence. Immigrant policing can result in deep feelings of fear and trauma that shape willingness to seek health services for IPV and may increase fears of police. And research must examine the health implications of policies that are not directly related to health. These immigration laws were not passed with any meaningful health impact, but have had direct health consequences. So holistic multi-level approaches allow for examining larger, perhaps hidden problems. So thank you. I think I'm under time.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, good.
You still have 3 minutes to go.
Oh,
that was amazing. Yeah, 3 minutes to go. Thank you so much for the presentation. A round of applause for our presenters again. So, questions?
I don't know how to remove this. I'm going to try so that our presenters can have it.
So, questions for our presenters. Yes, please go.
That's what I'm trying to do. I was going to turn it over there, but, you know, I'm trying to be... Actually, we have somebody that's supposed to help us in this room. I don't know how this is going to work.
Yeah, if you could stand up there.
Yeah, again, thank you. Those were all really amazing presentations. As a resident from an immigrant family in Georgia, this is particularly interesting to me, and I was really curious about if there were interviews done with the police themselves, because these aren't necessarily, the roadblocks and everything aren't happening in every county, and I don't know if all the, I mean, there are Latino police officers. I don't know, I just feel like it's complex and too. It would be interesting to hear the perspective of those who are enforcing the policy.
Yeah, absolutely. Can everyone hear me okay?
Could you use the microphone?
Yeah.
Our presenters, you guys might want to come sit over here.
Is that okay, please?
Because for people that want to ask questions, looking at you might actually
made somebody remember what they were thinking about before.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's a great question. So police weren't actually included as part of the formal data collection, but indeed I reached out to many police officers, and you're absolutely right. We can't really be presenting the police as this, you know, monolithic agency, or all police and local law enforcement officers as something monolithic, right? So there's actually a great deal of officer discretion, and I had heard from numerous undocumented immigrants that I spent a great deal of time with that they were fortunate enough that when they got pulled over a couple of times, police officers would let them go. So I certainly don't want to present this as something generalizing that these are all police behaviors, but rather the point here is to emphasize that police are given then the discretion through the enforcement abilities built into HB 87 federal statutes. They are given the discretion to arrest anyone just on the suspicion of being undocumented. So it's not necessarily that they are doing it, but they are allowed to do it. And just being allowed to do it is what perpetuates the fear. So it doesn't even necessarily have to happen, right? So this is the way that fear can work, even if it's not happening, even if there isn't a great deal of data to suggest that people are actually being stopped.
I have a question for all the panelists. Certainly, my colleague Lydia Lea, who is our ability to explicitly look at the role of coalition building, agency, and mobilization by immigrant leaders and communities. So maybe if you all can just, anyone wants to take up the role of agency and action, including immigrant children and families and young people in the solutions around the around the layers and complexities and issues, the barriers that all of you have uncovered, where do you see that role in your communities, and maybe are there commonalities across the nation? You know, we have different hotspots in the nation. So.
Illinois Coalition for Immigrant and Refugee Rights, we do strongly believe that immigrants should be the ones to voice their own opinions, as well as obviously there's also everyone should be working towards immigrants' rights. But even for us, though, we found that we weren't including as many undocumented in our organizing roles as we should. And I think it's easy to forget about making your voice diverse and making sure that everyone is getting a voice in how we're organizing our actions. There are a lot of undocumented organizations that are led by undocumented people that do a lot of advocacy work, but you do have to seek them out. Especially with a lot of college students, we've had INCHUL as an organization in Chicago that's been doing a lot of work. So I think, yeah, definitely, you know, you don't want to be the one creating priorities for someone else. You should be talking with them about and asking what their priorities are.
And I'll have to lead. I know you have more questions for our panelists because they're instead of work, but I need to make this big announcement. We have our new website, aphacrih.wordpress.com. For the purpose of refugee and immigrant health. The reason I'm announcing the website is this seems to be a topic that is of interest to everybody. For the last 3 years, I believe, or 4 years now, we've been running topics related to Affordable Care Act, Affordable Care Act and immigration enforcement. I brought that up because this was a topic proposed by a member. They emailed us saying, you know what, why don't we do a section around this? So in 2012, we had a special session on these, and we had a packed room. And since then, we've tried to keep this topic alive. It
just also want to add, like, we have something similar in Illinois as well, and we're actually are trying to push a law called the Trust Act, and it would break that cycle and prevent the police from basically racially profiling and arresting for someone on a nonviolent crime and then putting them into the system and holding them until the deportation enforcement comes in and takes them. So as like with coalitions, I think you can, you have bigger power and you could make laws that protect people.
I just wanted to add something because I think that's a great question about working in coalition and making sure that the voices of immigrants are put forward. I think it's really important that as public health practitioners, and particularly coming from the research perspective, that we don't reinvent the wheel. As we know, the immigrants' rights movement in this country, while it has not necessarily achieved all the things that it wants to, and that's why we're still here in this room today, is incredibly powerful. And so I think as public health folks, we have a responsibility to think how our work can support their work, as opposed to kind of figuring out how to get them to help us with our work.
There's a question over here.
Oh,
I think
you
the first speaker about the
Illinois.
Oh, they're still answering?
Oh, no, it's fine. No, it's fine.
No, I just wanted to sort of give the Minnesota context as well. And I think that, I think the reason that that I wasn't finding that parents were experiencing as many barriers is really because we have so many great immigrant-serving organizations that are doing outreach. And most of those organizations do include immigrants in their advisory boards. And there's also, there's people here in the room that do very rich CBPR work also in Minnesota. And then we also have a really strong coalition of immigrants who are themselves undocumented who have been organizing around healthcare access and then just last year brought legislation to the state to get driver's license for all. And so there's a very strong group as well in Minnesota that are organizing and in active rooms.
I just want to say that it's very important that when we talk about including people who are going to be receiving the services or who need the advocacy, that we keep in mind that just by adding them into a coalition or into a board, it's almost like, oh, community participation check. Well, no, that's not how it should be. We should do it very... Yeah, we have to make sure that it's the right setting for people, that they're going to feel comfortable, because a lot of the times I get asked, well, you do it. Well, yes, but I'm a professional, and I decided to stay with my community. I decided to work in the community that I live. I decided that it was this group of people, that I was going to stay there, and I make a collection, a connection. I'm a link to the organizations, but I also work and live with my community. And so then it's very different than just saying, oh, community, check. Oh, I got the voice of the community, check. That's not the way it should work.
There's different levels, right? So marketplace phone operators that were doing application enrollment, in January, they actually started allowing certified navigators to interpret for their clients. Around the same time, they also had a contract, or at least all the operators were told they had a contract with the interpretation agency. So the marketplace enrollment telephone line did have other languages. Experian, however, even up to now, I don't think they have a interpretation line. They're still not allowing certified navigators to interpret. And the appeals phone line, again, is separate. Even though it's still part of Marketplace, they're not allowing navigators to interpret. Every now and then they will allow it, but that's really a fluke and not a line, you know, a guideline that's been established. Right. So, I mean, throughout this whole system, my organization is mostly an advocacy organization, actually. And so throughout this whole year, we've been writing up all these instances when we had problems and it prevented enrollment or delayed it. And we've been sending it not only to our state, but also we work with national advocates like National Immigrant Law Center, NILC, and we also are working with local advocates that work around health and trying to make sure they're on top of everything. Because they will go out and we try to advocate and change things. But again, we don't have a state system. It's harder to change something that's at a federal level. We're the voters for Illinois, and so if we go up to someone and say, if you don't do this, we're going to talk about it, and you'll lose votes, they're going to do something, or at least attempt to. But when it's at the federal level, it's easy for a lot of the local people with power to say, I can just tell the federal ones, and then I don't know what they're going to do about it. I don't have control.